The Washington Post and its, we'll put in quotes, journalist Liz Sly continued to write, other moderate fighters. Now, it said the other moderate fighters are on the run. So, you know, here you have people that you're assuming are moderate militants. That's really funny. They're moderate militants that you have been arming. And when they were confronted by the only moderate party in this whole thing, in the sense that the al-Nusra isn't as overtly Islamic as the Islamic State. If you were to query the and study the tactics and speeches of al-Nusra, which says that their purpose is to establish an Islamic caliphate and to establish Sharia law, that you would rank them on a 1 to 100 scale of being fundamentalist Muslims at a 99.9. But the Islamic State they're pure Mohammed. They are kidnap, enslavement, rape, pedophilia. They've got it totally down. They are 100% Islamic. And so since al-Nusra is only 99.9% in compliance with Mohammed's life, his words and deeds, and the Islamic State is 100%, then to that degree, al-Nusra is more moderate than the Islamic State. So this idea that the real moderate fighters have now joined the al-Nusra, they have really now become, I guess, the pacifists, which you'd have to say before. Now they've become a moderate. So but there is no such thing as a moderate fighter. They were on the run anyway. They were headed for the Turkish borders as the extremists closed in, heralding. Now, we used to call the extremists the Islamic State. But now we can't call the Islamic State the extremists if we're calling al-Nusra, which is more moderate than the Islamic State, the extremists. Heralding a significant defeat for rebel forces Washington had been counting on as a bulwark against the Islamic State. Well, if that's what they were counting on, and I know that Republicans, both sides of the aisle, I mean, I get some pleasure out of listening to SRN interview people that went into polling stations saying they voted for none of the above. And that's essentially what I did by voting for the two libertarian candidates, is to say, you know, none of the above. But if that's what the politicians thought they were doing in Syria, then they're squandering our money, squandering blood, killing people for nothing. The fact is here, all you got is a religious war. It goes on to say, moderates still remain a strong presence in southern Syria. No, they don't. Southern Syria is completely taken over by the Islamic State. That's just the reality of it. The Islamic State controls southern Syria with exception of Damascus. Damascus is in southern Syria. And in the Damascus area, there's really just one control mechanism in the Damascus area, and that's Assad and his regime. That's Syria and the Assad regime have become a city-state, the city-state of Damascus. They've either lost or completely destroyed homes and everything in northwestern Syria. The city-state of Damascus is their reign of control in southwestern Syria. So northwestern, they've destroyed homes and everything else. I mean, there's just nothing left. Southwestern, you got a city-state. The rest of Syria is controlled by the Islamic State. I mean, are there some alcoves of al-Nusra? Yes. But there is different from the Islamic State as the two red Crayola crayons in the two different boxes of Crayolas. I mean, they may be different by, you know, some marginal amount, but it would be too little to tell. The White House spokesman said Sunday night that the Defense Department was best positioned to provide a battlefield assessment of what these alleged reports mean for the current military campaign in Syria. But the Defense Department didn't respond. Wow. So the commander-in-chief is saying, well, you know, I don't want to admit that my plan failed. So I'm just going to say, you know, the Department of Defense will answer your questions. And the Department of Defense says, he said, what? We don't have any answers. We're doing what he told us to do. It didn't work. The Islamic State becomes more powerful. They're better equipped. All the while, America's squandering its prestige and its military. I want to talk briefly about something that is near and dear to me, and it's aviation. As you know, last week there were two aviation tragedies. One is that NASA, for some unknown reason, decided that it would attempt to ferry a cargo capsule to the International Space Station. We've been using SpaceX effectively to do so. SpaceX is a private company and provides that service more reliably and more efficiently than the federal government does through NASA. But rather than just simply honor that contract and have SpaceX continue to re-equip the International Space Station, NASA decided that they would launch their own rocket with a very expensive payload capsule designated for the International Space Station. Well, it not only blew up, destroying the payload, but it also took out the launch pad in Virginia. So I can't tell you if it was tens of millions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars that were destroyed at an instant. But I can tell you that the Russian advice as to what we should do relative to our astronauts on the International Space Station is becoming more sage advice all the time. And they advised us to get a really big trampoline to get them back home. In addition to that, of course, Abominator, the price for tongue-lashing the Russians about the Ukraine, and aggravating the situation in Ukraine so we could tongue-lash the Russians and then put on sanctions against them. Since the Russians were providing most of the rocket engines that we were using, even on our defense-based spy satellites, and since the Russians have the only manned space program today, and therefore the only means to get our astronauts back from and up to the International Space Station, the Russians said, you know, we're not going to sell you the rockets anymore because you're using them for defense purposes. And by the way, I don't know what you're going to do about your astronauts on the International Space Station because we're certainly not going to help you out. So the Abominator was forced then to give contracts to SpaceX and to Boeing to reestablish a manned space program just to ferry astronauts back and forth to an antiquated and should be abandoned space station. And the price tag for that, at least just for the first phase of it, was $7 billion. $7 billion, most of which will go to Boeing, to get started reestablishing a manned space program, all the while the best of NASA's rockets blew up and took out the spaceport along with it. Now, the other issue was that Virgin Galactic, the program that was designed to take a rocket-propelled aircraft underneath a an airplane, rather than launching a capsule via a rocket or a shuttle via a rocket, which is extraordinarily dangerous and expensive. The concept was that you would take a small shuttle with a rocket engine in the back up to 50,000 feet. And at speed, that would be a speed that would be, you know, maybe Mach 0.8, maybe even slightly above that, but Mach 0.85, speed of sound, you know, varies depending on the density of the atmosphere. So therefore at altitude and temperature, but, you know, 767 miles per hour, is a number that's thrown out for standard conditions. And so you've got a miles per hour. So you've got this shuttle, if you will, very small shuttle, that's latched underneath the wing of an airplane that takes it up to 50,000 feet. Now, a lot of airplanes actually fly 50,000 feet because the cabin pressurization system's differential and the structural integrity of the skin of the aircraft doesn't like that kind of pressure differential. And you want to keep the cabin below 10,000 feet and up at 50,000 feet, the differential could be 10, 12, 15 times. I don't know the exact math, but it gets to be pretty significant for an aluminum shell. But there are airplanes that can do it, and you take the airplane up to that level, and then you drop it at, say, 0.85 Mach, and you fire the rocket engine, and it will take the aircraft to slightly over Mach, maybe 1.07, so just shy of 800 miles an hour. And at that speed, you can gain altitude, and it's kind of a suborbital ride, and it gives the passengers inside, you know, a view of the curvature of the Earth and a feel that, you know, they're in space. Now, it was dropped on a test flight, and the co-pilot died, and the pilot sustained serious injuries, and the spacecraft itself, if you want to call it that, was destroyed. And the rumor is that the co-pilot improperly deployed what was called a feathering device. Now, when we return, we'll talk about what a feathering device typically is on an aircraft and how that would differ from an airplane now that has a jet engine. We'll return in a moment. So here's the story. Now, understanding that when you, like this story begins, this feathering technology, that, and put feathering in quotes, in an airplane, when you become a pilot either of a high-performance single-engine turbine aircraft or a twin-engine pilot, both of which I am, you learn to feather the prop. If you have an engine failure or you have a engine malfunction that is serious that you think is going to lead to a failure, you feather the prop, which is you, rather than having the prop blades be reasonably flat against the angle of attack or against the way the airplane is traveling through the air, and therefore biting the air, creating a wing effect, pulling the airplane forward. You, by feathering the props, you turn the props so that they wind vane. You know, like if you put a wind vane on the house, whatever the fattest part of the wind vane is, it's going to be pushed by the wind so that it is in line with the wind, but typically the tail end of the wind vane, the broadest part of it, is furthest from the wind on the pivot point. That's when you put a feather on an arrow, it causes the arrow to align with the direction of the angle of attack. And so that's what you would typically do. A twin-engine airplane, the reason that you would feather the inoperative engine so it doesn't create a drag. An airplane with an engine and propeller that isn't feathered creates drag, and so on a single-engine turbine airplane, you'll glide further without the drag of the flat propellers when you feather the propellers so that they are not flat against the wind, but angled so that the broad part of the blade is in the direction of the wind. And in a twin engine, you do so that you don't have one engine on one side of the airplane creating propulsion and the other side creating drag, which would just have the airplane, you know, spin around in circles. So you'd have no control or lesser control over those circumstances. But there are no propellers on a rocket. And rockets typically don't even have control mechanisms in terms of amount of propulsion. You know, typically a rocket, it just burns until you've burnt out of fuel. It gives you a jolt, and when the fuel is gone, you know, it's a controlled explosion that sends the force of that explosion out the nozzles. So I would assume that the feathering mechanism on this airplane, the orbital airplane, if you will, even though it doesn't go up to it doesn't obtain orbital velocity, is to primarily to align the airplane such that it is fighting the direction of the wind, that it stabilizes it so it's pointing directly into the apparent wind or the air mass moving around the aircraft. Stabilizes it, which is important as you reach Mach, the sound waves around the aircraft, you've got to be really careful the way that they move around the aircraft. But this device evidently was also used to slow the orbit. So you would accelerate with the rocket and reach whatever altitude you were going to reach, and then you would deploy these on the descent to slow the aircraft down so that you could, as the air becomes thicker, control it effectively. Well, what happened is that somewhere between Mach 9.4 and Mach 1.02, as the aircraft was accelerating and fired its jet, the co-pilot deployed this feathering device. It's working against the rocket. In other words, it's trying to slow the aircraft like speed brakes do, which pop out the tops of wings or bottoms of wings of aircraft. It's trying to slow the aircraft while the aircraft's accelerating, and the aircraft broke apart. And evidently that is what occurred. And Richard Branson, who has a reputation of being an honorable individual, managed to rally to the situation and said to all those people who had the large deposits, I think it's $250,000 to get a 15-minute ride in space. He says, if you want your money back, that's fine. If not, we'll figure out a way to do this safely, to his credit. We'll be back. Returning to the Virgin Galactic story, the aircraft has like a lot of now sophisticated airplanes, has a video flight recorder in addition to the audio flight recorder, in addition to the black box that monitors all inputs from the pilots and co-pilots and feedback from the engines and hydraulic systems and electrical systems, and as well as external feedback on air density and air speed and air temperature and that sort of thing. And so in the video, it is shown that the co-pilot, without direction from the pilot, prematurely pulled this lever, which caused a feathering action, a technology, to deploy while the aircraft was accelerating under its rocket power, and that those actions change the aerodynamic forces in such a way to cause the breakup of the aircraft, and therefore everything was lost. Speaking of losing, as a matter of fact, it was interesting. I saw that today's Washington Post, the lead story is, you know, what's gone wrong with the Obama presidency? The Obamanator was asked to do a campaign speech for gubernatorial hopeful Tom Wolf. And so, you know, when Obama ran for president, there's so many numbskulls out there that bought into change we can believe in and all sorts of complete disconnect with the fact that almost everything the man said was untrue, that he was wholly unqualified to be president, that he had no concept of economics at all, never worked a job in a business, much less made a payroll, never built anything in his life, that he had no concept of the military, no concept of how to act internationally in international diplomacy, and no concept economically, that, and he was a novice politician on top of that, that this man was going to be change we could believe in. Well, it was change in the sense of total and complete dishonesty and ineptitude. And so he would give speeches that the Democratic Party would have extraordinarily well attended. Well, he gave a speech in a basketball arena auditorium on behalf of a gubernatorial candidate, Tom Wolf, right before the election, and less than a quarter of the seats in this small venue were taken. Three quarters of the seats in what is a tiny venue were empty. For a speech by the President of the United States. Imagine if the press had actually been fair. And somebody with a video camera from the press were to go to the back of the room and show the President of the United States sitting up there at a rostrum, you know, all the stuff in the background to make him look presidential. And to show that he was speaking to an empty auditorium. The White House pool report said that Mr. Obama's speech at a basketball arena in Philadelphia was empty, and that those prepping the venue partitioned off much of the arena to make the speaking area smaller and more intimate, and still they couldn't fill the seats. Press in attendance even noted that the floor area was filled with open spaces beyond even the empty seats. He has lost it. That very few people would now view him as a benefit in any way. Now I still drive behind cars that have I'm stupid as their sign and have Obama campaign paraphernalia on their bumpers. But they're few and far between. And there is the, amongst all rational and informed people, the realization that this man is completely ill-prepared to be president of the United States. He does not have any clue as to how to manage the military, how to manage international affairs, or how to manage the economy, and that he has been counterproductive in all three areas. He is completely ill-prepared to be a politician on top of that. And the only thing that he was good at is making speeches in using campaign rhetoric. And as it turned out, almost everything the man says is untrue. He is a liability. Counterproductive, can't be fixed. This is a story is from Nina, Wisconsin. It follows in that same genre that we have discussed on previous shows. Postmaster Brian Smoot said Monday that an investigation is underway into whether a city mail carrier dumped hundreds of pieces of Republican campaign flyers into the trash. The post office recovered nearly 880 pieces of political mailings, too late, of course, to do any good, Thursday from a dumpster at the Nina apartment complex, special agent for the U.S. Postal Office said. We have an ongoing investigation here. If it is determined that there was any wrongdoing by a postal employee, the end result can be all the way to removal or criminal prosecution. Well, I guarantee you, the individual who dumped the literature will not be removed, because most people in the administration of the Postal Service would be liberal. And the problem today with the voting machines that turn Republican votes into Democratic votes, and federal employees, like with the Postal Service, trashing Republican literature, is that to the degree they have been educated, it has been liberal political jargon, indoctrination. They've gone to schools where political correctness has run amok, where there is no sense of right and wrong, where there is no exercise of good judgment, where learning rhetoric, debate, logic is not part of the curriculum, where people are discouraged from passing judgment and encouraged to accept mutually unacceptable ideas that are overtly in conflict with one another. And so they have no ability to think, and this is generations now that have been raised this way in America, have lost the ability to think in a logical, responsible, discerning way. And without the exercise of good judgment, they've lost the ability to be moral. And they've been indoctrinated in education, academic institutions, where Machiavellianism, the ends justify the means, seems to be appropriate. So these individuals don't even know that they're doing something wrong. They're beyond morality. They become amoral. And the more liberal the individual, the more amoral the individual has become. This notion that the liberals are the caring, compassionate ones and the Republicans are the ones out to cut everybody's throat and to be aggressive and to be greedy and take what isn't theirs isn't right. Now, I'm not going to claim that Republicans are moral, but by comparison to liberals, they are.
They're both like that. They both want things that aren't theirs. They're both over-aggressive, and they want things that aren't theirs.
More so, though, with the liberal, communist, socialist agenda, where the vast preponderance of liberals pay very little, if anything, into the government, and want to maximize the entitlements that they receive from the government. That's a liberal use of government.
No, you're 100% correct. Republicans are definitely the big bad evil, you know, boogeyman right now. But I mean, give it, you know, 4 years, and they might be reversed. I mean, that's how they're both evil. They're both you're talking about two sides that aren't paying for anything. Neither one of those people are.
When the Speaker of the House is Boehner. And he speaks of George Bush punching Putin in the nose. You're dealing with just utter stupidity. When the Republicans vote to supply hundreds of millions of dollars to weaponry to moderate, we'll put this in quotes, moderate militants in Syria to attack the Islamic State. You're dealing with nincompoops. So I would agree with you. While they're both bad, there is a moral gap that exists within the politically correct, liberal-leaning individuals who are prone to the Democratic Party because it's more socialistic. And so their morality is even more suspect than the morality of conservatives.
They're offering people something for nothing. They're letting people vote money into their wallet. They're saying that the money that that a Craig or a Larry or anybody else has, they're saying that it's not fair that you guys have that and that everybody should right. have that. When not everybody is running a business, not everybody is taking the risks involved in running a business. I mean, everything that goes into a business, there's so much more than the money that you have at the end. How much money are you putting in the beginning in order to, you know, get that payout at the end? I mean, and to think that there's people out there that look at that and they think that they had something to do with that and that they deserve something out of that, that's ridiculous to me. That is so, there's something so wrong with that. That, I mean, that's that little kid that sees another kid riding a new bike, and he decides, you know, rather than saving up his money to go get a bike, he decides, I'm going to push that kid off and drive that bike around.
Because I like it. It's the mentality of trying to change things such that it's perceived as being beneficial to you without it being beneficial to the other party is an agreement that is destined to fail. You know, if you take too much from somebody, for example, that is productive, they'll stop being productive. And then you have become dependent on someone who is no longer productive. Everyone loses. That's this problem of such agreements. Welcome back to Shattering This. We have Glenn having called in from Philadelphia. And I know I'm probably vulnerable in what I've said about Republicans and Democrats and that I don't like either of them, and I made it sound like I thought that one side was slightly better than the other, and it's kind of like comparing Ebola to smallpox. I had Glenn on the line hoping that he would take me to task for something I said, and he dropped off, so... I don't know why. Maybe he didn't like the introduction that I was giving. I was actually trying to introduce him favorably. Yeah, he's sometimes when he takes me to task, he does a good job of doing so. And I realize that in speaking of Democrats and Republicans, I am I'm vulnerable. Well, we do have Glenn back again, so I don't know what the reason was that he got disconnected. But hello, Glenn.
Yes, I'm back. That was very weird. Just as I was about to, you were about to have me call, like, totally dropped. You know, I tried to call back and said, mobile network not available.
Oh, okay. Well, I feel a little bit vulnerable because I did infer that Republicans are slightly better than Democrats, but only in the sense that there is, no morality in socialistic, democratic, liberal thought, and there is some, 1% of morality and judgment that may be left in conservative thought, but, that's like saying, would you rather have smallpox or Ebola?
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it's interesting. I'm getting ready to go out to my local polling place. I'm going to vote, but... I'm an old school paleo conservative.
I used to consider myself a paleo conservative until I realized I didn't have anybody to vote for as a paleo conservative.
Yeah, that's sort of a problem. There are a couple, and that's actually sort of lesser evils type of thing, participating in the blocking of the greater evils, perhaps.
Yeah, and you actually are conservative in the sense that you want to conserve what government does, as opposed to a liberal use of government, you want to diminish the influence of government. There is a political party that might garner 1 to 2% of the votes. It's like voting none of the above, and that's the libertarian candidate is most likely and aligned with your views than anyone else. He's just not electable.
And the only problem is and the danger there is, unfortunately, there's been a huge amount of money pouring last minute into these third-party coffers, probably from liberal
right.
ranks, in order
Correct.
To split, take votes away from the Republicans.
Correct.
So
yes,
yeah.
That is true. And I will tell you that with a Democratic administration, I'd rather have a Republican Senate and Congress to create absolute gridlock, because the less our government does, the better. Our government almost never does anything good, so the more divided they are, the better. And since America has changed radically in terms of the balance of power between the between Congress, Senate, and the White House, with the White House usurping more and more dictatorial authority. So you almost need both chambers of Congress to oppose the administration to keep squandering America's resources.
And my concern is that if you hand both houses back to the Republicans, and if you in the background get creeps like Cheney and Roe in there again, these mercenary fascist types, that's terrifying.
It is terrifying.
Mitch McConnell is head in the Senate, majority leader in the Senate, and get Boehner the heck out of the way in the House, and not have fascist weirdos, you know, manipulate, pulling the strings, they might actually be able to get something useful done. But they,
But you know, I do think that the there's a senator from Texas that has been showing a lot of. Of authority, trying to encourage a complete transformation of the country. Now he might be a paleo conservative, but typically the really conservative Republicans are way too pro-military. And too hawkish, and so they're really, since that's a huge area of spending, that's really dangerous, and I've not seen any conservative willing to tackle Social Security, which is, you know, the huge drain on our country. So it's pretty hard to find a scenario that is beneficial. You know, it's, they're bums on both sides, and I think that for a while we're going to deal with Democratic administrations in the White House. So gridlock could be a good thing.